Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 485, Conversation with Robert Perry and Lucy Commissar. This has been recorded on November 14th of the year 2004. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to introduce Robert Perry and also to bring in Lucy Commissar. Lucy, Robert, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the Iran-Contra affair and specifically the investigation of the Contras trafficking in cocaine. Robert, briefly sum up for us what we talked about on Side 1, John Kerry's primary role in the congressional investigation.
Right. Well, after the Associated Press wrote the first story in late 1985, it was John Kerry who picked up on that information and began his own investigation using members of his own staff to see what could be found out about this problem, to see if it could be stopped. The Contras were well supported by the Reagan administration at the time, and Kerry came under a lot of heat and pressure not to proceed with the investigation. He kept plugging away, however, and did do a report in 1989, which was perhaps the first American government report saying that that aspects of the U.S. government had turned their backs and averted their eyes to drug trafficking coming into the United States. That was not a well-received report. The major press, Newsweek, Washington Post, New York Times, and L.A. Times, did not give it much attention. It wasn't until the late 1990s, when the CIA did its own investigation of the Contra drug matter, that Kerry's findings were corroborated. The Inspector General of CIA, Frederick Hitz, put out two reports in 1998 which said that the Contras were deeply involved in drug trafficking and that the Reagan-Bush administration had concealed evidence about that, about those illegal operations.
Lucy, you have written about the BCCI case and about John Kerry's role in investigating that. This obviously overlaps the Iran-Contra investigation. I wonder if you would sum up the BCCI case as best you can, given its many connections.
Okay. The BCCI was a criminal bank. It was set up in 1972 by a Pakistani banker with some Gulf area bankers. And one characterization of it, which was quite apt, was that its business plan was money laundering. And it worked for drug traffickers. It worked for terrorists. It worked for fraudsters. And it worked for the CIA and the U.S. government, sending money to Osama bin Laden when the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen against the Russians in Afghanistan. And it also was used to move money in the Iran-Contra scandal. One of the companies that was set up to move the money was BCCI. One of the accounts was in BCCI. And, in fact, North signed checks drawn on the Paris branch of BCCI. BCCI was also used to move money to Saddam Hussein. There was BCCI funneled millions of dollars to the Atlanta branch of the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, an Italian bank, so that it could make $4 billion in secret loans to Iraq, and that was money for arms. The bank, by the way, the Banco Nazionale del Lavoro, was a client of Henry Kissinger, and he was on the bank's international advisory board. So that the CIA knew all along that BCCI was a criminal bank involved in drug trafficking and all kinds of illegal activities, but it didn't want to stop it because it was also the CIA bank that was used for all kinds of black ops. Well, Kerry found out about this through investigations into the Iran-Contra scandal. And he wanted to look further into this, and he was stopped all along the way. He was a junior senator, and he was only the head of a subcommittee dealing with narcotics. He thought this ought to go into the banking committee. The banking committee was run by Don Riegel, and he would not allow this to move along. Kerry finally was able to get at one point one day of hearings, and he had to pay for the staff and investigations himself. They wouldn't pay for it. The investigations, though, turned up a lot of information, and when Kerry's chief investigator, Jack Blum, found clearly that the U.S. Officially would not do anything, the Justice Department would not do anything, the CIA stonewalled the Kerry investigators. So he took the information and went to New York District Attorney Robert Morgenthau, and he is the one that did the investigation that led to a grand jury indictment. And a month later, the U.S. government, the Justice Department, was forced to hand down an indictment, but it was much more limited. But if it hadn't been for Kerry, his investigators, and Morgenthau, nothing would have happened to the bank.
And John Kerry did not get a medal for his BCCI investigation, did he?
Hardly. He didn't get anything. He was able to finally have some reports issued, but really only because he was pushing it all the way and using his own staff. But the Justice Department made a deal with BCCI at one point. They found them participating in a drug trafficking operation in Tampa, Florida, but it was only a little piece of what they were doing, and Kerry wanted them to take on the whole operation, including, by the way, illegally getting involved in some U.S. banks, using fronts such as Claude Clifford, who had been a former defense secretary. The CIA knew about that, and they passed on reports to Treasury Secretary Donald Regan, but it never moved into the Justice Department and into actual prosecution. They seemed to want to keep this dirty bank alive. The other thing that's very interesting is that there was a George W. Bush connection, because one of the big stockholders, the figures are either 20% or 30% of BCCI, was Khalid bin Mahfouz, and he was a partner with a Saudi named Farron, and they were involved with a guy in Texas named Bass, and they financed Bush's first oil company, Arbusto. And then when the second company, which bought out Arbusto, Harkin, got into trouble, BCCI was in some way also involved in bailing it out. So the Bushes had a very direct connection to BCCI through these individuals. Now, another interesting thing about these individuals is bin Mahfouz was the man who started and was on the board of a charity, a Saudi charity called Muwafaq Foundation, and the U.S., after 9/11, declared that it was moving money to Osama bin Laden, and Yasin Qadi, al-Qadi, the person who was a director of it, was put on the American terrorist list, the bad guy list of the 9/11 terrorists. So here's somebody who was connected to this charity, which was put on the list of, and he was a director of it, one of the charities supporting bin Laden and al-Qaeda, connected to Bush through various funders who were connected to BCCI, which was getting dirty money from many, many sources, including moving the money of the CIA.
Lucy, you've written extensively about some of the offshore banking havens and the role that they play not only in corporate politics but also in some of these national security-related investigations that we've been touching on. I wonder if you could briefly give us a summation of some of our previous conversations about the Clearstream Network, what it is, and how that also relates to things like BCCI and some of the other investigations we'll talk about.
And by the way, BCCI was registered in Luxembourg and Grand Cayman, which are two offshore places that practice bank secrecy. Even though its offices officially were in London, it was able to move its money through these offshore places. And offshore has grown up. Initially, they were islands, but now it means any place that practices bank and corporate secrecy where you don't have to put down the real name of the owner of the bank account or of the company. And it's pretty easy then to hide what you're doing from law enforcement. And that's why BCCI ran its operations through places such as Grand Cayman and Luxembourg. Now, in the October surprise, you remember the U.S. Embassy was seized in Iran in November of 1979, and there were 52 American hostages. And there were negotiations going on with Carter. With the Carter administration, the Iranians wanted to get money. There had been some billions of dollars frozen after the Iranian Revolution, frozen in U.S. banks. They wanted to get the money back. They also wanted some arms that the Shah of Iran had ordered and paid for. But the Reagan campaign, according to many sources, negotiated secretly with the Iranians and promised that if they held off coming to an agreement with Carter and if they didn't release the hostages, who had been in for quite a long time, some years, that they would get a better deal from the Reagan people. This became known as the October Surprise. So Reagan won the election. Carter people continued to negotiate, They didn't get anywhere. They made an agreement, actually, to release $4 billion, but no hostages were released. Now, according to Ernest Backus, he is a man from Luxembourg, and he had been the number three official of Clearstream. Clearstream is a house of compensation. What that means is what when an individual or a company buys financial paper, that is, they buy stocks or bonds or derivatives from someplace, perhaps it's on the other side of the world or even if it's on the other side of the country, they need to get the stock and they need to move the money. The problem with the moving the money is you don't just put it in an envelope and send it there. How do you do it? Well, you do it the same way that we move cash. That is, there's a debit and a credit system. Banks belong to houses of compensation or clearing houses, and they have accounts, and the money is debited and credited, and then the bank itself gives its client or takes from its client the money that goes into the account. So Clearstream, which is in Luxembourg, is a house of compensation for financial paper, and it handles billions of dollars every year in these trades on its account. So Ernest Backus had been the number three. He was fired in the 80s. He said it's because he found out he was finding out things that he wasn't supposed to find out, and he was curious about what was going on with the Banco Ambrosiano, which was the Vatican Bank, which turned out to be a very crooked bank before BCCI, but that was the big bank scandal then, a lot of money going offshore. He got fired, but while he was, that was in the 80s, but he was still there in 1979. He told me a few days before the Reagan inauguration, I was working for Clearstream. It was then called Sedell. The name changed later in the 90s, late 90s, early, perhaps around 2000. Sedell got an urgent instruction from the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank and the Bank of England to transfer $7 million in bearer bonds. These are bonds that don't have anybody's name on it. They belong to whoever has the actual piece of paper. To transfer that, $5 million from an account of Chase Manhattan Bank and $2 million from an account of Citibank, but these accounts were of subsidiaries in offshore secrecy havens of Chase and of Citibank. The money was going to go to the National Bank of Algeria and from there to an Iranian bank in Tehran. And he was told, he told me, that the $7 million was a small fraction of the money being sent from around the world, concentrated in the Algerian bank, and it was going to go to transfers that were, he was told, linked to the fate of the hostages. Now, the Fed and the Bank of England are not members of Sedell Clearstream, and therefore they didn't have the right to order these kinds of transfers. Backus told the president of Sedell that what was going on. His superiors were not there, but he was given at least he was not stopped from acting, and he acted to execute the order. I spoke to the man who was the president, and he declined to respond to phone or email messages about these facts. And so January 20th, after Reagan took the oath of office, the hostages were freed. So the point really is that they have lied, of course, ever since then. And in the Reagan administration also had a vice president called George Bush. And the assumption of people is that he was involved. There have been stories that have continued that he was in Paris negotiating with people from Iran. And so we have that connection again. It was run through offshore subsidiaries of Chase Manhattan Bank and Citibank. And one assumes that the other money was also collected offshore through Sedell, now called Clearstream, to the bank in Algeria and then to Iran. So that is another offshore operation. And again, it's why one reason why the offshore system isn't being shut down. We can see in both these cases that the CIA used the system, the CIA or other secret agencies of the U.S. government used the offshore system.
Robert Perry, for Consortium News, you've done a lot of work on the October surprise. I wonder if you'd tell us some of the investigations that you'd conducted and also relate to us how the congressional investigations and journalistic investigations of October surprise were attenuated, because it's not dissimilar to the situation vis-a-vis the Iran-Contra and BCCI cases.
Right. I spend a good deal of time, actually, in the new book, Secrecy and Privilege, going through what happened in the 1980 election, because it is a pivotal election in American history. And the real history of it has been obscured. As Lucy says, there is strong evidence now, overwhelming evidence, that the Republicans did interfere with President Carter's hostage negotiations. He was trying to get the 52 hostages out of Iran. Obviously, he wanted them out before the election. The Republicans, first, I think, were mostly trying to just keep track of what he was doing. I think, but that seems to have evolved into more of an obstruction. And Lucy's also correct to point out the connections with Chase Manhattan and with BCCI. The evidence is now quite strong that elements, the people working for Chase Manhattan, played roles in these connections to the Iranians for the Republicans, and that BCCI was involved in shipping money to one of the Iranians who Carter believed was working for him, but he appears to have been a double agent, a man named Cyrus Hashemi. The FBI was wiretapping Hashemi's office, and just before close to the inauguration of President Reagan, there was an intercept about BCCI sending a payment via Concord flight to Cyrus Hashemi, who was believed to have been in a back-channel way helping the Republicans, although pretending to help President Carter. Shortly after that, the wiretaps were removed and nothing was pursued about that mysterious payment to Cyrus Hashemi. But Lucy's correct in that some of these mysterious banks and some of these mysterious financial interests do intersect with the efforts to frustrate President Carter in 1980.
And the investigations into the October surprise really went no place in Congress, and yet, as you've written about in Consortium News, there have been a number of corroborations from foreign sources, including a Russian intelligence report, which tends to corroborate the fundamentals of that investigation.
Right. There was an investigation that was finally forced to be undertaken by Congress in 1992. I had been brought on by Public Broadcasting's Frontline program to look at this issue in 1990 and 91, and we did a documentary that was very hedged, very careful. We didn't draw really conclusions. It was more a state-of-play sort of documentary saying these allegations have been around. Here's what they are. Here's what may be questionable. Here's what might be more supported. That documentary and a piece in the New York Times by Gary Sick, who was a National Security Council advisor to President Carter, prompted finally the Congress to look at the issue more seriously. They undertook a task force, mostly in the House. On the House side, there was a small investigation on the Senate side. However, the attacks on the story were so intense, coming from often the neoconservative elements, which were growing in prominence in Washington at the time, and by some parts of the mainstream press, including Newsweek, where I had worked, that the investigation got off on a very bad foot. Plus, President Bush was running for re-election. He was aggressively attacking the stories, saying they weren't true, saying he had never traveled to Paris for any meetings, although he never submitted to any kind of serious questioning about those points. So essentially, the story was ridiculed more than addressed. What happened with the investigation was that it was trying to find ways to bury the whole story, but as they got past the election of 1992, suddenly a flood of information began pouring in to the Congress, which supported the October surprise allegations. There were more witnesses coming forward, people who were considered highly credible. It was one New York Times reporter who had done the biography for the head of French intelligence, who had said that Alexandre Desmaranges, the chief of French intelligence, had admitted to him that he had been party to these negotiations. So you had this a wealth of information coming from both Iranian international sources, even some American sources. So in this context, you had the chief of that investigation, Lawrence Barcella, who by the way also was a BCCI attorney in an earlier period, saying to Congressman Hamilton, who was the chief of the task force, that they needed 3 more months to even evaluate all this new information. Hamilton refused, and they wrapped up the investigation with a dismissive report. The report was supposed to be issued on January 13th of 1993, a week before President Clinton was going to be inaugurated. 2 days before the report was issued, however, the Russian government, which had been asked if it knew anything about this sort of routinely by Hamilton months earlier, shows up with a report. And the report was from their intelligence committee and their Duma, and it said that yes, this, according to their intelligence information, the Republicans had met with the Iranians in Europe, they had struck a deal, and that they essentially had outfoxed President Carter, who was trying to reach his own deal. That report and much of this other information was never released officially. It was the report came out. No, we were never told that there was this Russian report. It wasn't until almost 2 years later, when I got access to the raw data, the raw documents of this House report, the House Task Force, that I found in these boxes secret and even top secret material that went against the conclusions of the report. And one of the documents I found was the classified version of the Russian report. And in fact, ConsortiumNews.com began in 1995. Because no one was interested in that story. And so we wrote it up for, and we started a website. It was one of the first magazine websites on the Internet. And we published a story based on this Russian report. And we published other material from those secret documents that I uncovered. But still, the conventional wisdom has remained that this isn't true, but the actual facts of the case go the other way. And one reason I did Secrecy and Privilege, my new book, was to show the strength of this evidence. And I spend several chapters going through this mystery of how this, chronologically, how these events unfolded in 1979 and 1980, and then also how the cover-up of those events unfolded in 1991-92. So it makes for a very, very interesting story, not just about the actual facts, these historically important facts, but also how Americans are kept from knowing their own history.
As we were speaking on November 14th of 2004, one of the stories that's dominated the news media the last couple of weeks was the mortal illness and subsequent death of PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat. You have had a couple of articles in the Consortium about an alleged PLO connection to the October surprise, including a very recent article by Morgan Strong. I wonder if you would encapsulate that for us.
Sure. Basically, one of the contacts that the Republicans made in 1980 to try to see if they could get channels going through to Iran was with the PLO. And actually, Morgan Strong did a piece, I think, for Playboy back in the 1980s, which had the first element of this, that Arafat and Bassam Sharif, one of his top deputies, had acknowledged meeting with Republicans on behalf of their interest in getting through to the Iranians to stop the release of the hostages. We followed up with that at PBS. We interviewed Bassam. We were not entirely convinced because he wouldn't give enough detail. But later, interestingly, when Arafat met with Jimmy Carter several years later in the mid-1990s, Arafat told Carter while sitting in the bunker in Gaza that he had been approached by the Republicans, that he was apologizing to Carter for having even accepted or listened to the offer. He said that he did not personally help stop the release of the hostages, however. Other PLO sources said that when Arafat went to Iran during the 1980 period, he discovered that the Republicans had other contacts that were achieving that end. So the PLO was brought in, and the The promise to the PLO supposedly was that if Reagan and Bush got into office, they would basically recognize the PLO as the sole representative of the Palestinian people, and give them other rewards. This Carter interview was recorded by Douglas Brinkley, the historian, and appeared in an historical quarterly in the mid 1990s, although no one really paid much attention to it.
We are almost out of time. We're running low on time. One of the things that, at one point, I'd like to make very quickly is that some of these subterranean activities, whether it's the offshore money flows, whether it's the behind-the-scenes covert operations, they have a great deal to do, not only with American foreign policy, but in the case of the October surprise, as it's come to be called, we're dealing with the manipulation of American electoral results. And that's something that I don't think should be overlooked in the wake of what has just happened in November. Also, frankly, treason. That's just not something that ought to be happening. Lucy Commissar, any last thoughts here as we wrap up the broadcast? Anything you'd like to comment on, or any point you'd like to emphasize?
One of the things I find fascinating is the networking among the bad guys. The same bad pennies keep popping up. Sometimes it's billion-dollar pennies, but the same names pop up, so that you get somebody like Bin Mahfouz that's connected through BCCI to the Bushes, and then he pops up also as an Al-Qaeda money person, according to the Americans who decided his charity was a terrorist funder. And then you realize that the CIA has known a lot about what has been going on over the years, and so that the real problem that we have in this country is often not that people don't know what's going on, but that a lot of the people who are in power have been connected to some of the guys that are doing some of the nefarious things that are going on. And that's the thing that just fascinates me. The same people, some of the same banks, come up over and over again.
One of the things veteran listeners may recall is the linking of the Banco Ambrosiano, which you mentioned, Lucy, to the Stibom arms for drugs ring used for both Iran-Contra and the Iraq weapons transfers as well. Robert Perry, last thoughts from you.
Well, what Lucy says as well is a good point, and obviously one of the key elements of this what's happened to our history over the last 30 years has been the Bush family. And that's why in Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, I follow their rise through these different events. And I think if you see how they have played and how naturally they have worked into this world of secrecy, and how, certainly with Senior Bush having come out of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1976 and the roles he played in the Reagan-Bush period, that what we have here is a real hidden history of our nation. Which continues to this day, because it's been continued through many of these same people who played roles in the 70s, played roles in the 80s. Some of them were some of the younger players then, like a Paul Wolfowitz, who was involved in 1976 in the so-called Team B operation at CIA, which went after the analytical division. He's now back as a senior person in the Defense Department. So some of the smaller players and some of the major players do keep recurring. And unless we know the true history of this period, there's really no way the American people will ever get a handle on it.
Thank you, Robert Perry and Lucy Commissar. Remember Robert Perry's website, www.consortiumnews.com. His new book, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to, what was the last part of the title, Robert?
From Watergate to Iraq.
To Iraq. We have been visiting with Lucy Commissar and Robert Perry. I want to thank both of you for your work and for your participation. For Lucy Commissar and Robert Perry, I want to thank you for listening. This concludes For the Record program number 485, Conversation with Lucy Commissar and Robert Perry, being recorded on November 14th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.